So the big question here, Mike, is how's the meditation practice going?
This one's going to take a little bit to become sticky. This is definitely not something that I naturally embrace, but every time I do it, it feels really great, which is not as often as it should be.
Do you notice, because I've been trying to do this as well, and I feel like I've been getting pummeled on all sides to start meditating. And so I'm dedicated to making it work. I just don't think I'm there yet. But can you see a difference the day you do it? I assume you do it in the morning.
Yeah, I can notice a difference, and usually it's just by the end of the day, me being feeling like I'm still in control as opposed to being ready to snap. It's like my crap tolerance wears out otherwise. By the end of the day, just like
Nice.
stay away from me.
It's like I just want to go to bed. Everybody leave me alone.
Exactly.
So I'm kind of jealous because I feel like I'm one of those people that I need to, I guess, stick with it multiple days in a row before I see or notice any difference from meditating. And maybe that's just my lack of self-awareness, which is possible. But I just don't see, whenever I do it that morning, and I'm using the app Calm for it, and they've just got a timed version of it. I don't do any of the guided pieces. I did those a while back and they never really helped me, so I just kind of do the silence thing. And that seems to work pretty well for me, but at the end of that session, I'm just like, okay, now what? And by the end of the day, I don't really notice it until I get a streak of about 4 or 5 days in a row. If I can get that streak of 4 or 5 days in a row, then I feel like I can start to notice it, which I guess is a pretty good instigator to keep to keep a series of days going in a row.
Don't break the chain.
I know, I know. But the nice thing is that because one of the other pieces that I have been adopting is the journaling piece. So I try to make sure that at the end of the day, whenever I'm doing that journaling portion of my day, that I'm discussing with myself how the meditation bit went. And I haven't looked back on them yet to see if there's much of a difference there, but I'm at least recording that. Hopefully that'll help me to at least see if there's any difference in the long run.
Yep, data-driven decisions.
I know. It's true. It's true. But the other piece of the journaling thing that I've been doing is, am I working my way towards the goals that I have set? Am I able to conquer the urges to procrastinate and beat those? Those are the ones I'm primarily journaling through. And the nice thing is that just, it's kind of like confession time, I guess, where I need to sit down and be honest with myself, and just having that period of time at the end of the day, that's extremely helpful. And it at least helps me see where some of those weak points are, and where some of the difficult times that I need to be on my game and be aware of step in, which is some of what we'll talk about today, in today's book. But I think that journaling piece, and you talked about jumping in and doing a little more journaling as well, or redirecting that a little bit. But for me, I've just found that being honest with myself and just being aware of the struggles that go on through the day and trying to figure out how do I overcome those? That's the big piece there that's extremely helpful.
Yeah, you got to know what works and what doesn't. And journaling is a great way to create a record of what works and what doesn't. And then when you look back at it, you have a different idea a lot of times of what actually transpired. And then over time, like you kind of lose the forest through the trees. But the journal, going back to your journal, can help you recenter and say, oh yeah, this is actually what happened.
Yeah, it's true. Has that, because you made some changes to your journaling process, I thought, right?
A little bit. It's still mainly the same. I'm kind of rethinking some of the prompts that I asked myself, and I've kicked around some different ones, but in the end, it's still fairly similar.
Okay, maybe I
Really
just,
the idea for me is just to, at the end of the day, actually think through what really happened and then kind of rate myself on how I did. And usually when I do that, I can find the tipping points for where my day either became really productive or I got off track. And then identifying those tipping points helps, because then you can avoid those situations in the future that kind of lead to that. So it's kind of like you see these patterns, at least for me, and then in the future you can see yourself start to go down this pattern, and you can catch yourself and say, oh no, I know where this is going to end up, and then you can course correct.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's primarily for me, one of the things that I'm trying to journal about is with my creative work, because I do a lot of writing. You and I podcast together. I'm stepping into kind of building courses, online courses as well. So there's a lot of that creative piece that comes in. And that's primarily what eventually led me to choosing our next book, The War of Art, by Stephen Pressfield. And the subtitle on this is Break Through the Blocks and Win Your Inner Creative Battles. I chose this primarily because whenever it comes time to sit down and write or generate a video or a podcast of some kind, for me, the podcast not so much, especially when there's someone else on the other line, just because there's the accountability piece there. But whenever it comes time to write, for a long time, I have had the mentality of, I just don't feel like I know what I'm going to write about, so I don't at all. And I know it doesn't make sense now that I'm thinking about it, but previously I would always come at it from the standpoint of, okay, I need to have the best scenario to sit down and write. And I could create that scenario, but I don't really want to, and I don't really know how. And what I mean by scenario is mostly a mindset. And I'm coming around to, how do I do this and how do I understand this creative work? And Stephen Pressfield, in the book, he talks about not necessarily saying that art has to be something creative in the sense of writing or painting or anything on those lines. He could also talk about building businesses, which I thought was interesting, because so many of us are building at least a side project, or like we're solopreneurs type. So just, how do you deal with that? How do you bring yourself to do that work? And what's the fight that's going to go on, the war in this case, to keeping you from doing that? So I know that I struggle with that, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to read the book.
Yeah, it's great for any creative type who's making anything. He talks a lot about the roadblocks and the resistance that people who have that creative mindset face. So you want to just jump in, and I know resistance is kind of where the book starts. You want to start talking about that?
I think so, because ultimately he starts, well, the whole book, if we back up here a little bit and say the whole book, the layout of it, he's got it broken down into three sections. I think it makes sense, Mike, to just work through them. Like, sure. Go through the first one, and then go through the second and the third. And the first one is all about resistance and, like, what is it that we're fighting against? In other words, who's the enemy? Who is it that we're fighting against here? I have some ideas on how to define resistance, but Mike, what are the resistance pieces that stood out to you when you went through the book?
Well, I think that resistance could have a little bit different definition for just about anybody. Anybody who's a creative type who has had a project that they've been working on, or they know they should be working on, has encountered resistance in some way, shape, or form, and they probably know exactly what you're talking about when you say resistance, which is one of the things that I really liked about this book. Like, you were talking about the resistance that you face when you sit down to write. He has a quote, and I just wrote down a ton of quotes from this book. He says at the very beginning, it's not the writing part that's hard. What's hard is sitting down to write. So for a writer, you're like, yes, that is exactly the issue. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can identify with resistance in that particular scenario. One of the craziest analogies, I don't know, maybe it's not an analogy, the stories that he told, conclusions that he drew was when he was talking about Hitler at the beginning of the book. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
He talks about how Hitler actually wanted to go to art school. And he just couldn't hack it. He has this quote at the beginning. He says, "It was easier for Hitler to start World War II than it was for him to face a blank piece of canvas."
Yep.
Which sounds a little bit extreme, sensational, whatever word you want to use there. But if you've been in that particular situation where you're like, okay, I have to create this thing, like, it feels like the entire world is fighting against you at that point.
It's so true. And, you know, if you use the writing example, which is easy to do because you and I are both writers in some form, whether it's for a blog or a book or anything, we tend to write quite a bit. And the struggle really is to get your butt in the chair to start writing. I mean, it's just not, at least for me, the process of writing is enjoyable, but getting myself to go do it is always a struggle because I don't know what I'm going to write about for the most part. And when he talks about resistance, and he puts all kinds of types of labels on it, and Pressfield is awesome at cutting, I guess would be the word for it. Mm-hmm. He can condense things down into a very small package, but it says a ton in very few words, which is awesome. But it also means that you end up rereading little sections quite a bit.
Yep.
And he does this significantly through the resistance definition piece. And it's just page after page of, you know, resistance. It's most powerful at the finish line. And it comes through procrastination. He even talks about resistance and sex. So it can take a lot of different forms. And for me, a lot of those, yes, it's a war. And for me, a lot of it is the procrastination piece. So if you go back to Kelly McGonigal's book from last time, The Willpower Instinct, I struggle a lot with the thinking tomorrow's going to be better, that mentality of not getting to it today because I think I'll be in a better position tomorrow. So I put it off to my tomorrow self instead of my today self, which is horrible. And it continues. And the next thing you know, you got a cycle and it's 3 weeks before I do anything. And it just continues. But
yeah, he actually says procrastination is the most common manifestation of resistance. We don't say I'll never do it. We say I'll do it tomorrow, which is exactly to your point.
Yeah. And I don't know why for me, maybe I should say I do know why. It's mostly because I don't want to try to put something out there that's not perfect. I'm definitely a perfectionist. I always want it to be as good as it could be. So it's easy for resistance to step in and say, oh, well, you're not in the mood to do it perfectly today. Let's do it tomorrow. And that cycle kicks off from there. It's not that I'm saying I'm not going to write or I'm never going to write. It's just that tomorrow will be a better time. You know, the kids will be out of the house. I'll have better coffee at that time. The whole space will be in a better place. I'll have it cleaned up at that point. I mean, you see how the list of excuses can just go on and on and on.
Yep, exactly. And that's what he would define as self-dramatization, I believe, which he says feeds resistance and it keeps us busy, but we're not productive. You know, if we focus on our situation and all the things that are preventing us, all those built-in excuses from actually doing the work, then we can say, well, I'm not going to have to deal with this situation in the future. But you know, going back to Kelly McGonigal's book, we tend to view the future as like the ideal, and it never plays out that way.
It's true. I wish it did. That'd be awesome.
Right.
But it never does. One of the forms of resistance that I thought it was kind of interesting, he talks about some of these disorders. Did you catch this piece, the self-medication bit? It was interesting that because he used to work for an ad agency, and one of the things that his boss used to tell him at the time was to invent a disease and come up with a disease, and you could sell a cure to that disease. And
right,
it's interesting that we do that so much, and some of the disorders that he lists there, I'm not so sure are actually marketing ploys. They might actually be diseases, but they're at least interesting that, like, take myself, for example. I've had a psychologist that says I'm ADHD. Well, just having that label immediately starts to give you an excuse for not doing something. And it's easy to take advantage of it, I guess. It's not that I'm saying I'm distracted and I can't focus long enough to write, or maybe I'm using that as an excuse. And that's one that I've previously used as an excuse. And to be honest, once I finished reading this book, my ability to sit down and write went up dramatically, just because you understand that it's a war and you start to put better labels on it, I guess. There's the label of the ADD piece, but having a label of something that combats that or potentially challenges that there's even the thing there to begin with will at least put you in a place where you're better able to go to battle. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah, definitely. And I thought that part was really interesting when he was talking about the marketing of the diseases. And he used a statistic. I don't know where he gets this, but he said that doctors estimate that 70 to 80% of their business is non-health related. Did you catch that?
I did. I thought that was interesting. I brought it up to my wife and she thought it was probably true, but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. But yeah, I thought of you specifically when he mentioned the ADD stuff. Like, oh, I wonder what Joe thinks about that.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I don't know if I'm coming to grips with the ADD thing or if I'm just rejecting it entirely. I've been calling it a race car brain. I'm not instead of ADD.
Right.
But
I like that.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about the labels in general, but it's at least interesting. And I'm, for me, as someone who's been given that label, I tend to use the book The Willpower Instinct, and now with this, The War of Art, I see them as tools to combat it, if that helps at all, because there's so much that goes on in your mind. And for me, I can bounce from thing to thing extremely fast. Just in general conversation, I can throw some people off, just being like, how on earth did you get there, Joe? I don't know. I just jumped four topics and landed there somehow. But just knowing that when I sit down to create, that there is this force, if you will, that's an enemy to be fought. And just knowing that there's something there to fight against and that there is a war against, that in and of itself helps tremendously for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the phrase that I really took from that first section was resistance understands nothing but power. So you're going to have to deal with this resistance, and you can't deal with it any other way than to smack it in the face and say, no, I'm going to beat you. You know, you can't ask it to leave. You have to overcome that fear that he talks about. Here's another quote. It says, if you find yourself asking, am I really a writer? Am I really an artist? Which I can totally relate to. Having published a book, I still ask myself that. He says, chances are if you're asking those questions, then you are. The counterfeit innovator is the one that is wildly self-confident. They're the ones who say, oh, I can do that tomorrow. You know, but the real one, he says, is scared to death. So recognizing that fear is going to be there is kind of comforting in some sense, because when you deal with that stuff, you, after reading the book, it's kind of like, oh, well, that's normal. Everybody in my situation is going to go through this sort of thing. It's not just me.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing your book, did you deal with this a lot? Was that something that you found difficult to overcome? And I don't know if you had read this book, because I think, isn't this a reread for you?
Yeah, it's the second time that I've gone through it. I can't remember when I read it the first time. It may have been before I wrote my book. But yeah, this was definitely something that I dealt with. But the thing that kind of grounded me, I guess, was the why, you know, why I wrote the book in the first place. I mean, just being really straightforward, I guess. My book is a Christian take on productivity. So obviously I have a Christian mindset that I approach it from. And my belief in God was really the thing that drove me to write it. I believed that I had to write this book, that I would be held accountable when I die for not writing this if I hadn't written it. And I guess, you know, depending on your belief system, anybody could feel that way, you know, where this is something that I have to do. But it was really tangible for me. It really like put a face or a picture on the reason for why I wanted to write it in the first place, which made it a lot easier to relate to and then follow through with actually doing the work.
Yeah, I can definitely resonate with that, because so many of the ventures that I've taken on in the past, there's a lot of strong motivation purely from, like in your and I case, from a Christian and spiritual standpoint, that there's such a strong pull towards that mission that the resistance is almost just gone at that point, because you have so much of that drive and that purpose behind what you're doing. And I can definitely see that. You know, there are sometimes when resistance really isn't there. Some of the articles that I write, some of the scripts or the small business ventures that I've taken on, they just happen. Like, I don't have to, it's not a war to sit down and do those things, just because it's enjoyable and it's something that I can get excited about, and I'm definitely on board with the mission behind it. So the resistance piece, I mean, who cares? It's not even there. It's not something I have to fight for. but whenever I go into something like writing articles for the blog, because I write 2 a week, that means that it's pretty easy to run out of ideas pretty quick, or it's not always something that you're crazy excited about because you've done it so much. And whenever you have something that you're continually trying to do repeatedly, that's, I think, when so much of this resistance and that enemy can step up, and the fear of putting it out there, or doubting what it is that you're doing, it's pretty easy for that to creep in and overtake it.
Yeah, and I don't think you need to have a Christian mindset in order to have like a spiritual why. I mean, even in the Stephen Pressfield book, he talks about the prayer to the muse, and he talks a lot about the supernatural stuff, angels and things like that. Later on in the book, he's got a little bit different take on it, but yep. The motivation is and a lot of the mental imagery that he uses, I completely agree with. You know, my mm-hmm. definition of an angel is probably different than his, but I think we, in terms of the whole spiritual realm, at least it sounds like there's a lot of synergy and agreement there in like what is actually driving this work forward.
Right. Yeah, and I'm gonna kind of pivot on you a little bit here. Are you familiar with Jeff Goins at all?
Yep.
Okay, so Jeff, he's an author, writer, and he writes about writing primarily, which is interesting. It's very meta. His big turning point in his whole career that I thought was interesting, and he talks about this quite a bit, was the day that he was talking to a friend, and he was grappling with whether or not he was a writer and whether or not he wanted to be a writer and all of this stuff. And how do you go pro, if you will? And the thing that his friend told him was, well, you just have to say, I'm a writer. And yeah. I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, but just the definition there completely changed the game for him. And it's interesting to me that Pressfield basically says the same thing. It's like, whenever you want to combat resistance, you need to turn pro. You need to step away from being an amateur and go pro with it, which is a simple process of making the decision that you're a pro. And he mm-hmm. goes through a lot of different pieces on defining what a professional is, which I think are really, really interesting. And just
yep.
the concept of turning pro and that it's a decision by itself, I thought that was interesting, because I've never really thought about it that way.
Yeah, and one specific aspect of that, he said that the professional tackles the projects that will make him stretch. So I think a lot of people have this picture that once you turn pro, you're really good at this and it's autopilot after that. But that's not my experience at all. And it sounds like that's not Stephen Pressfield's experience either, and not how he would define it. But it's constantly seeking out those projects where you feel like you're over your head. So when I wrote my book, for example, I had no idea how to write a book. I just figured I better learn how to write. So I started a blog just so I could get some practice, do some reps. And there wasn't ever a point, it wasn't, after I published the book that I was like, okay, yes, now I have arrived. Now I am a pro. But looking back at it after I read this book, the moment I turned pro in my eyes, and according to Stephen Pressfield's definition, was the moment that I decided to chase this project that I had no idea how to complete. And if you do that enough, you'll find yourself, you'll end up somewhere that you never thought you would get. Because when you take on those projects that stretch you don't know what the end goal is going to look like a lot of times, right? You at least don't know what the process is going to look like to get there. You have to kind of figure it out as you go. And recognizing that that is part of the process, that is what a professional does. It's not just the things that you know how to do and doing them over and over and over again until they become automatic. That makes me feel a lot better about my process and my story and what I've gone through. So
Does it still feel weird if somebody calls you an author?
yes,
I've
absolutely.
written a book as well, and I've had a couple people refer to me as an author, and I almost want to contradict them. It's like, I don't agree with you. I'm not an author. I just happen to have written a book. Like that's all it is. So it's not something, it's definitely an internal thing, and you kind of just have, like Pressfield says, you have to make that decision, but it still feels weird if somebody else calls you that.
Yeah, I would argue and that the thing that makes you a professional is the fact that you're going to show up and do it. He had a quote in there that I really liked in that section on turning pro about the athlete. It says the athlete knows that the day will never come when he wakes up pain-free. He has to play hurt. And then there was another quote kind of related. It's Somerset Maugham. Is that how you say their name? It says, I write only when inspiration strikes. Fortunately, it strikes every morning at 9 o'clock sharp. It's recognizing that there's never going to be that perfect scenario. The circumstances are not going to be ideal. The stars are not all going to align where you can finally, now I've got the time to sit down and make your thing or write the book or launch the project, whatever the case may be. But to show up and do it every day anyways, even if it's not a big, substantial amount of time that you're investing in that project, just the fact that you show up every day, I would argue, is the thing that makes you a professional as opposed to one of the spectators who sits on the sideline and is like, I'll do that tomorrow. They've got the ideas, they've got the inspiration, but they never actually take any action on those goals and those dreams and those visions that they have.
And you combine this with his, as he's going through the definition of a professional, he also has one where he says a professional plays it as it lies. And it makes a lot of sense too, because he comes at it from a golf standpoint. You have to play the ball where it lands. And whenever you're fighting against resistance, whenever you turn pro, the circumstances, like you're saying, they're not always going to be perfect. It's not like you're going to be sitting with a straight, perfectly level green, ready to putt exactly with no wind, no anything, birds not going to sweep in and take it. Like everything's going to be perfect and ready for you. Like that's just not the way it is. Instead, you have to make sure that you're willing to, in this case, go to war to continue to do the work. So, talk action items here. I couldn't help myself, so I got a head start on this, Mike. And for me, and I've written about this in the past. I have two different desks in my office. One is a writing desk and one is my computer desk. And I do all my writing with pen and paper. I don't do it with a keyboard. I always end up transcribing it, dictating it into the computer later. Well, with that writing desk, I have found since reading this that I just have to make sure that there's a certain time of the day, which for me is first thing in the morning and then again after second breakfast. I'm semi-hobbit. Whenever I get back down in my office after second breakfast, that's another time when I sit down and write. And in both cases, what I have to do, and going through some of his suggestions here, you know, accepting no excuses, just doing the work, making sure you're ready for it, and setting up all of the environment for that, I have to make sure that my phone stays upstairs or is somewhere else in the office where I can't get it. The computer's off. And I'm able to just sit down, and the only thing that's in front of me is a pen and paper. That's all that I have available to me. If that's all that I'm able to do at that time, then my only choice is to go to work and to do the work and beat resistance in that case. So I've had to set some of that piece, those pieces up. And it's interesting how once you sit down in that chair, after you do that for 3 or 4 days in a row, just sitting in the chair with a cup of coffee, it's crazy how everything just kind of magically takes over. And I think that's what he gets into in the third book of this, the third section of the higher realm and the muse that he talks about. I think I would disagree with him on a lot of it, but the interesting part for me that I found is if I sit down and I've got that set time and I've got that set of, you know, those circumstances put in place, and I don't really have any other choice, then the work is pretty easy to do, honestly, which is a very good thing.
So, Joe, I have to ask you this because you have a separate writing desk. So you're probably the most qualified person that I know to answer this question.
Okay.
Since I watched Alice in Wonderland with Johnny Depp, I have been wondering, how is a raven like a writing desk?
I can't answer that question, Mike.
Darn, I thought for sure you would know.
Very good question. I don't have an answer.
But I digress. One thing that I wanted to go back to when you were talking about your setup, this whole section on being professional really spoke to me. One thing he said, though, is that being a productivity guy, I really like this. He said, the professional will not tolerate disorder. He eliminates chaos from his world in order to banish it from his mind, which I would argue is exactly what you did when you set up your writing desk. You wanted to make sure that there was no distractions, there was no chaos. When you sat down to write, everything was in order. You've got your pens, your notebooks, I'm sure, just sitting there ready to be picked up, and you've eliminated all that friction that could get you to the point where you say, I just don't feel like it. I'll do it tomorrow. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything has to be clean. It has to be, literally, the notebook has to be open and the title of the article or whatever it is I'm writing has to be already written at the top. Like, yep. All I can do is grab the pen, uncap it, and go.
Right. So that actually led to I'm just quoting different quotes that I really liked from this book, but the professional dedicates himself to mastering technique, not because he believes technique is a substitute for inspiration, but because he wants to be in possession of the full arsenal of skills when inspiration comes. That, to me, is the whole reason for productivity and the whole reason for the organization that he's talking about is you want to make sure that there is nothing in the way when that inspiration does happen. You want to make sure that you can click in as easily as possible, and as Cal Newport would say, do that deep work, you know, the deep focus work that's really important. That's, you know, Stephen Pressfield's approaching it from a creative stance, and Cal Newport, I guess he would define deep work a little bit different, where it could be literally anything, but I think there's definitely some alignment there where when that state of flow is there for the taking, you want to make sure that you're not too distracted or there's not friction in your system to the point where you don't recognize it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of, because we're heavy in the productivity space, Mike, and there's a large amount of productivity tips and tricks and apps and tools that their whole purpose is to eliminate friction and resistance. I mean, look at tools like, take Drafts, for example. It's an app for iPhone that you open it up and you can start typing into it. And then after you type the text, you can send it somewhere else. The whole point of that app is to remove resistance in getting something out of your head or to send it somewhere else, but you don't know where it's going to go yet. Like, the whole point is to remove that resistance. And
exactly.
If you spend any time in the productivity space, you start to see that this is a recurring theme. Like, so much of what we do and the tips and the tricks and the stuff that we come up with, the scripts and all of it, primarily comes down to removing resistance to the point where you could almost define productivity as removing resistance. It's kind of ridiculous. Yeah. If you get down that far.
That's true. The other thing, I'm kind of going back to the middle section, and we were talking a little bit about the third book, but
right.
The other thing I want to just touch on, I guess, is the whole idea of You Incorporated.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
That was really a light bulb moment for me, because when it comes to especially my personal projects, I am a terrible self-promoter. I created a video course, which I give away for free. I don't even sell it. Yep. And I can't even get myself to tweet about it. I did it one time when I launched it. So
it's true. And I did the same thing. Like, I'd recently sold 1,000 copies of my book. So I wanted to be, you know, awesome and offer a huge discount on it. And just to say thanks, I guess. And, of course, I write the email. You send out your almost obligatory tweets and posts and emails to everybody to let them know about it. And you inevitably get people that are upset about it. This is another set of things that Pressfield talks about, is when you get those critics that come in, because you put something out there, you're doing something to help, you're putting your heart on the line. And whenever you do that and you're doing it to help, you want to promote it, you want it to be successful, you're always going to have people upset about it. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it goes. But the trick is to not listen. And we know this for a long time, you know, don't feed the trolls. And so much of that is true here, because if you start creating things to not get critics in order to not get the feedback, the negative feedback, it ends up being, how would you put that? Non-successful, non-dramatic, I don't know what you want to say there, but something that's not as beneficial or helpful to other people, even though
exactly
you're putting a lot out there, it's not as impactful. That's what I'm trying to say.
It's got to be authentic. It's got to be who you really are. He talks a lot about the self versus the ego, and he talks about how, specifically in that last section, he talks about the hack versus the professional, basically. And the hack, he says, doesn't write what's in his heart. He writes for his audience. And then he asks a question, which was really, really good. It says, if you were the last person on earth, would you still do this? Because a lot of times we can get caught up in writing for the audience and writing because we want to create things that we think are going to be successful or are going to sell. And there's definitely a place for that. That's part of the equation, I would say. But really, that whole last section of the book where he's talking about the muse and he's getting into his spiritual reasonings and his spiritual why, stuff like that, it really kind of hit me between the eyes. Like, okay, so you wrote this book because you say that you believe that you had to do it. Well, then why wouldn't you promote it? Like, yeah. If you really do believe in this thing that strongly, let's see it. You know, where does the rubber meet the road? If if this was just something so you could, you know, check it off on a list, then yeah, don't tweet about it, don't promote it. But if you really do believe that you got this thing because the world needs to hear this, then you really can't care. Like, it has to go farther than just the creation, I guess. If you really believe in the message and the thing that you're creating, it's going to be a natural extension to promote that and get it out there so that other people can see it. And you're not going to care about the criticism, or at least you're going to keep going. You're going to overcome the criticism. You know, the criticism is really just the manifestation of the fear that he talked about in the first part of the book. And it can be really tough. Like, I know with my book, it's available on Amazon. I don't remember the people who leave the glowing 5-star reviews. I remember the one guy who says, yep. Oh, I don't like it because of this, this, and this. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. That's not what I'm saying.
Yep. So for example, if you're on my email newsletter, all it really is there's some original content that goes with it. And then it's mostly just a feed of the articles and podcasts that I put out. So, and I never send out like these promotion type emails. I don't ever do that. And it's partly because I don't like getting them. I'm okay with one or two every now and then, but not every day. Like, it just gets to be overwhelming. So I don't like sending them out. Well, I recently sent one out. And of course, there's a lot of people that were saying thank you because they loved the thing I was promoting. But at the same time, there's one or two guys that come back and say, a marketing advert? So sad. Like, really? You did this? Like, well, of course I did this. I want you to know about this. It's something awesome, and I want you to be able to participate in it. So you really have to get past all the haters out there, because you're not doing it for everybody. You're doing it for a small subset. Now, the part that's interesting to me on that whole story with the email bit is that nobody unsubscribed over that at all, not even one. It's like, okay, so if you're so upset about it, why did you stick around? So
right,
anyway, it's interesting to me how, because the anonymity that comes with so much of the critics today just means there's a lot of them. And I don't want to belabor the whole critics and haters and trolls bit, but there's a lot of it out there, and you don't have to write online very long before you start getting pummeled with things that really, really don't matter. You just have to look past it.
Yeah, and I think writing maybe is one of the safer ones, because when you write a book, it's expected that you're going to sell it. Think about all the developers who spend 3 years creating an app that they sell for 99 cents, and people are leaving 1-star reviews because they have to pay for it.
Yeah,
you know, it's absolutely the same principle times about 100. With the App Store economics, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Good grief, that's a nightmare there. Ugh. Anyway, so if you go on to the third book, the third section here, Pressfield gets big into spiritual forces, angels, I don't know what else you'd call them, but he gets pretty heavy on this. And his view, and I'm pretty sure you're with me in disagreeing with him here, but his view is that when you sit down to write, let's use that example because it's what we've been talking about. You sit down to write, and whenever you hit that flow or that creative juice starts to come through, he's saying that's not you, that's what he's calling the muse. And it's them putting the words and the creativity into your mind so that you can impart it on the world. Is that a fair description of this?
Yeah,
I kind of struggled to understand it a bit.
that being said, I do think that there are, like, me specifically, I guess there have been times where I will be doing something and evaluating the effectiveness of it, and be praying. In Stephen Pressfield's instance, he'd be praying to the muse. I would be praying to God.
Yep.
And I'll get an idea, which I know, like, that's not something I would have thought of myself. So, and it ends up being the right thing.
Yep.
So I do agree with him on the point that you can get ideas from, I'll just say, the spiritual dimension.
Yep.
I do believe in that part of it, but I definitely don't think it works the way that he thinks it works.
Yeah.
Where you kind of just tap into it. There is a big part of it. Like, you have to create the environment. You have to show up. You have to do the work, like he's talking about in the first part of the book. And because there's a whole book devoted to this, I think it maybe is emphasized a little bit more than even Stephen Pressfield would, if you sat down and had a cup of coffee with him. I'm not sure he would put this on the same pedestal as, or at the same level of, the Turning Pro section.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I would certainly agree with you on the spiritual realm. I'm definitely with you in that camp. And I think there are times when this spiritual dimension, as we're calling it, would give us words in that sense. And I'm definitely on board with you there. I think it starts to get a little funny when he starts to, when it's not necessarily a, you know, if it's not someone coming from God in that sense, I would tend to disagree with him there, but that's the Christian worldview coming through. Mm-hmm. But the part of it that's interesting to me is because he even calls out, he even gives you the exception saying, you know, if you don't believe in these spiritual beings, then just think of it as this force of nature in some form.
Right.
And I get that. And at the same time, every time I was reading The Muse, I kind of translated it to the mindset in my mind. To me, it's less of a force. Like, whenever I sit down to write, and I definitely hit that flow, and at this point, it's almost every morning, which is awesome. And whenever I do that, I don't necessarily think of it as some external force giving me all of those creative words. I tend to think of it just as a mindset, and given the circumstances and me setting myself up for it, creates that trigger to allow myself to think in the way that I need to think in order to write the words that I need to write. Does that make sense, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what my book is is about, is the that from the Christian perspective, there are a lot of people who think that God will just show up and do everything for you. Not my experience. He'll tell you what to do, and then you have to get busy and actually follow through and do it. He's not going to just snap his fingers and poof, you're in your dream job. You know?
Right.
In fact, my experience, my story is, I've kind of lived it out now. You know, when I started to write the book, that's kind of what led to me getting my job at Asian Efficiency. I started blogging, and for about 2 weeks, I posted every day at 5 a.m. before I left for the office. And then Asian Efficiency posted that they were hiring. At the time, I wasn't even interested in a full-time job. I said, no, I don't really want to do that, but any opportunities for guest posting? And they said, well, we really don't do that, but if you have anything, send it over. Sent over my blog that I started 2 weeks earlier. And they said, yeah, there's a lot of synergy here. We've read a lot of the same books, a lot of the same mindsets. We're going to give this a shot. Now, you know, one thing led to another, and now I'm full-time with the company, and there's a lot of synergy between my Christian belief system and the company's core values, even though they don't share the same mindset. But you have to do something with that idea that, in my opinion, God has given you. You have to be a good steward of it. So once you do that, the score takes care of itself, as Don Shula would say, but you've got to step out there. If you never make the first step, nothing's ever going to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's some of this that comes out in, you know, you don't want to go back to the very beginning here, where my experience was always waiting for that perfect scenario. Like, you're waiting for this mindset to just kind of creep up and take hold of you. It's not going to work that way. You have to create the circumstances and the place for that mindset to come out. And this is where I think it's about 2/3 of the way through the third book, he actually shifts away from the spiritual realm, which makes me think that he's not putting the emphasis on it that we originally think he is, even though he spends right. A lot of time on the muse and the spiritual forces. He spends a lot of time there, but he does shift off of it before the end of the book to talk about territory and hierarchies. And what he means by that is, take the hierarchy thinking, for example. So you tend to put yourself in order, like that person's better than me and I'm better than this person. Like, well, that's just, we tend to want to do that as humans. He's saying not to do that, which makes mm-hmm. perfect sense. If you're going to be an artist in some form, that you would want to think of it more as, this is my place. This is my territory. This is where I go to work and nobody can touch me here. That's what he's getting at there. I think that makes an awful lot of sense. Take the writing desk, for example, Mike. If someone else were to sit down at that desk, well, it's not going to work for him. It's not going to do a whole lot for him. It's set up for me. That's my territory. Right. I know that whenever I go down to that desk and I go to work, I'm going to be writing about productivity or tools or apps or something. If I'm doing that, then that's my game. That's where I'm at, and I know I'm good at that. And I need to be okay with saying that because that's a place where I am a professional. That's what I do. So that's my territory, and I know it. And I know your territory is similar to that, but I think you're a little more broad than I am.
Yeah, my territory is basically wherever I can sit with my computer. And then my latest toy is these Bose QC35 headphones, which are awesome. They are Bluetooth noise canceling headphones. So I now, for the first time, have the ability to basically create that territory wherever I am. And it is a game changer because I do have an office, but it's about 10 minutes from my house, which is where I'm recording this podcast from right now. I have my mic set up here and it's my probably 8x10 office with no windows. I call it my hobbit hole where I go and nice. I need to just focus on something and
so we're both
crank
hobbits.
Out a project. Yeah, yeah, definitely. But yeah, so the ability though to sit down at my writing desk, which is literally just my laptop. I have been around computers my entire life. I mean, my dad was taking me to do presentations with him when I was 3 years old and, you know, booting up the Apple IIe's. So it's just really comforting for me. Mine, you know, it's digital, it's not analog like yours, but it evokes that same emotion and that same, I don't even know how to describe it. It's the sense of like, okay, I'm home. Now it's time to just like, this is my territory, like you were talking about. This is my domain. This is where I can make stuff happen. And so, yeah, the principle definitely still applies.
One of the quotes that I thought encompassed a large portion of the book here as a whole, he's talking about a professional and the order that's needed for that. And this is what he says, because he's also got a story right before this where he talks about living in the back of his Chevy van. You remember this? And he had right. to dig out his typewriter underneath layers of tire tools, laundry, books, and he had a bunch of stuff in the back, and he'd have to dig out his typewriter in order to write. And then he says this: the professional cannot live like that. He's on a mission.
Right.
He will not tolerate disorder. He eliminates chaos from his world in order to banish it from his mind. He wants the carpet vacuumed, the threshold swept, so the muse may enter and not soil her gown. I thought that made a lot of sense, and it really encompassed so much of what he says in the entire book, that there's a lot of chaos and resistance, for lack of a better word, that can try to prevent us from creating. And we need to keep everything in order to allow us to step in and do that creation and allow that mindset to skip away from the muse words, to allow that mindset to step in and take over and help us to create the thing authentically and honestly in that case. So I think that really helped me a lot to just think about it that way.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. The organization aspect of going pro is so important. And then, like you were talking about, the key then is to, once you have the environment set up, you have the atmosphere created, you're organized to the point where all the friction in the system is gone, then being authentic. That was the big thing that I took away. You mentioned a little bit earlier, you can't define yourself hierarchically. you can't compare yourself to other people. If I were to compare myself to Jeff Goins, I wouldn't do anything because I don't have the level of experience or the level of success that he has. And that would be, in Stephen Pressfield's terms, a win for the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing he said near the end of the book is that the biggest fear we have is that we will succeed. Never really thought about that before, but when I read that, it was like, yeah, that I can totally see how that would apply. Like the whole being bad at self-promotion thing. As long as I don't self-promote, I have a built-in excuse for my book to stay small.
Yep.
But if I were to step out there and to really go all in, I don't know what would happen. You know, it's possible that it would not be a New York Times bestseller. Probably wouldn't be, honestly. But it was interesting to think about the fact that we stay with the things that we're familiar with. We stay where we think it's safe. And we don't step out there because we don't at some level want to deal with the, like if the book were to blow up, I have no idea how to handle that situation. So it's on a psychological level, almost easier to just say, I'm fine with things the way they are. I don't want to see what happens, which is kind of sad when you think about it that way.
It's kind of a depressing note there, Mike.
It is. Well, I don't mean it to be depressing, but it's also my big takeaway, I guess, was like, okay, how much do you really believe in this thing that you created? You know, it's time to put your money where your mouth is. You know that there are things that you can do to promote it and get it out there that you aren't doing at the moment. And so I was forced to look at myself through the eyes of, okay, am I an amateur or am I a professional? Because a professional is just going to get out there and they're going to make this happen and let the chips fall where they may. The amateur is going to say, well, I'm too busy. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. And I'll get to that tomorrow. And it was kind of compounded because I also had a conversation this week with somebody else in the productivity space, Sean Blanc, that I respect. And he was asking me the same thing. He's like, well, you know, is this a priority for you? Like, is this something that you really believe in? Or are you okay with the fact that this may never be something big? And when you frame it that way, it's like, yeah, I got to just shut up and do it.
Yep. You got to get to work.
Right.
You can't just let it slide because we know what's going on as it slides. Like as things are just moving along currently, we know how it works. And when we create something and we put it out there, it's kind of scary if it goes big. Like it's scary if it gets to be something large and more than just not knowing what to do if it does go big. There's also the problem of lots of people seeing my heart mm-hmm. and seeing me. And that's fearful. I mean, that's not something that's easy to grapple with because you really have to be vulnerable. There's a lot of hype right now, I guess, for some of the books from Brené Brown, I believe. Brené? I think that's how you say it. She's written a lot about, you know, just being vulnerable and stepping out there. And that's not an easy thing to do because there's so much of the closeness and the potential for lashing back at you from like the critics like we were talking about. There's so much of that can just be thrown back in your face. I don't want it thrown back in my face. I don't like it when people tell me that I need to just stop writing in general, which, you know, I get some of those every single day. It's like, okay, what? What are you talking about? So you really have to just get over that. I mean, that's one of the action items that I have for going through this book was get to work. You know, don't wait for perfect circumstances and just remember that it is a war. And just knowing that you're in a war at all means that you have the ability to think about it as something I have to win. instead of it just being how you do things. You stop thinking about the how and you start thinking about the why behind it. And I think there's a lot of power in that, because then you can really start to sit down, know that you have to get your butt in the chair and do something instead of just waiting for the perfect scenario to come along, because it's not going to happen.
Right.
And for me, the physical action item that comes out of this, and we were talking about journaling at the beginning, and I'm adding to that after reading this, of because I don't always have a good view of my own art, the words that I write. I tend to, it's rare, Mike, that I'd read something I've written and think that was really good. It's just right. The way it is. And I know that it helps people. I'm aware of that, which is why I continue doing it. But at the same time, I don't always feel like it's not a good place to be. So one of the things that I'm trying to do is come through the reading of this and come to the mindset of, you know, what I'm doing is good. And I know that it's helping people. And I see those emails, I see the feedback on that. So I know that what I'm doing is good work. I need to be okay admitting that and say, yes, I'm good at this, and know that I'm okay with being a professional, and then admit that, yes, I am a professional at this. But that's one of the physical action items for me here, is to journal about the feelings that I have about my own art, which can be kind of philosophical, I suppose.
Yeah, the big thing for me was to actually do what I've known for a long time I need to do, in terms of being willing to self-promote and being willing to get the message that's in my book out into the world, to not be okay with the fact that it just sits on the digital bookshelf as something that I've done, but to really embrace that. If that's going to be my legacy, if that's my personal brand, if I really believe in that message that I wrote, I need to double down on it. I need to follow through with the next steps there. And actually, there's a quote in the art, the War of Art, that kind of encapsulates it perfectly. It says, "Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, magic, and power in it. Begin it now." It's like, okay, I guess I got to do it now.
Yep. Get to work.
Yep, exactly.
All right, Mike, how would you rate this book?
Man, that's a great question. So I really like the content of the book. Some of his word choice is a little brash for me.
Yep.
And some of his imagery with the muse and stuff is, that part was kind of hard for me to get through. It's kind of like, I don't know. If there was a one point in the book where I wanted to put it down, that was the spot. But it definitely is very impactful, and I think that it definitely altered my mindset and how I view things, even the second time reading it. I'm going to say 4.5 stars.
All right. I'm with you on, like, when I got to book 3 and he started talking the muse, I almost skipped it. But I was like, okay, I can't skip it because I have to sit down with Mike and talk about it. So I think if we weren't doing this, I probably would have skipped probably the good half of that third book there. But I'm with you on, it can really change a lot. And I know that, as we were just talking about with the action items here, just knowing that I'm okay with my art, I'm okay with being a professional, and being willing to label myself that, just coming out of it with that mentality is huge, in my opinion. I mean, it's just, it has a huge impact. So I'm with you there. It has a huge benefit in being a book to read. So if you create it all, I would highly recommend it. But I'm with you on sections that I just completely disagree with, or really had to swallow hard. Like, it was just tough to get through. So there's some pieces of that that would make me want to drop my rating quite a bit. So I would put it at a 4 even, mostly because I would debate between a 3 and 4, 4.5, somewhere in there. So I'm going to land on a 4-ish.
4-ish.
4.0, I'll call it that.
All right, 4.5 and 4-ish.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. All right, so Mike, next book up is your choice. What are we reading?
The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday.
Nice. And then, so we're going to start reading that one now, which means that we'll record and review that. Well, not review it, but we'll talk about it in 2 weeks. And the one following that, if you want to get the book for the readers here, or for the readers, we're going through books a lot, Mike. for the listeners, we're switching mediums here. For the listeners of the show, if you want to get the book that follows that, we're going to step into Essentialism by Greg McKeown, right? I think that's how you say it. I looked it up. McKeown, I think, is right.
Could be. I've heard it McKeown.
I've heard a lot of them, and that's why I looked it up. I looked it up, and I still think I'm getting it wrong. But that's the one that we'll read following Mike's choice of The Obstacle is the Way. So that's the one that you would want to pick up, because I know it takes time to get books if you're going to read the physical copies. So that's the one that would follow it. So Obstacle is the Way is coming up next. Following that is Essentialism, and then Mike has to decide what comes after that, but I'm not going to make you do that here, Mike.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Any last parting words, Mike, on the war of art?
Nah, get to work.